Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. And well, this is our first time ever actually doing a proper podcast, like a sit down with microphones, chat, mix board, the whole sort of shebang.
Yeah, in front of a live studio audience right here at the NEC.
Yeah, we've not made it easy for ourselves.
Hello, Nebworth.
Yeah. I'm Jesse Billington, the title staff writer and the idiot that suggested this in the first place. And I'm joined today by the title's editor, David Simister.
Hello and welcome. Yeah. Great to be at the NEC, back for the Classic Motor Show.
And we're joined by regular contributor to the title, and might I say, motoring media man, Andy Talbot.
Yes, across everything that makes money. Pays the mortgage, yeah.
Yeah, so we're here to sort of obviously have a little bit of motoring chat and look into sort of what goes into making the title, what things crucially we're looking forward to or have already seen this weekend. But we'll kick it off with a nice little introductory round to sort of introduce ourselves, because this is the first time we've ever done a proper podcast. And we'll talk about the classic cars we own. And David, I'll start with you, because yours is a lot more upbeat than my situation.
Yeah, so I've owned a string of classic cars over the years. My first car was a 1984 Mini. It was very reliable in that every week I could rely on it to break down. So that was my first classic car. I've since moved on to, I had another Mini. I had an MGB GT that I absolutely loved for a very long time. I owned that for the best part of a decade. Up until very recently, I had a Reliant Scimitar GTE, and my current set of wheels is a Mark 1 Mazda MX-5, which I'm currently in the process of mending, you know, keeping it going, just treated it to a new roof. So that's what keeps me busy and drains me of wallet funds.
Very much a rolling restoration, I think, is the best way to describe your car. Andy, what about you? What have you got sat in the classic garage? What have you had before as well?
Yeah, I don't tend to like rolling restorations, because after about 3 years, they tend to go. So I think at the moment, I'm kind of known for my quirky VWs, and kind of I was growing up with my grandfather having things like K70s and 411s and that kind of stuff for the engine in the back. I've got a VW Thing at the moment, United States version of what people call a Trekker. So it's basically a boxy Beetle. Found it in Texas, and it's a survivor car. So it's basically, the idea behind that is I don't need to do anything except conserve it. So I'm on the conserving side of things. So yeah, I can drive it. So that tends to be what I do, really. Work shy, is what my wife says.
Meanwhile,
you did have a very lovely Porsche 914, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a 914 years ago. Again, that was the first thing I'd learned to drop an engine out of. And that was purely, I was just saying before to Sarah Crabtree about dropping out engines. And I learned how to drop the engine out of a 914 by watching Wheeler Dealers and Ed China taking one out. And it was 4 bolts, that's all it was. Drop the engine transmission straight away, and I could work on it. So that's the only and the first engine that I've ever taken out of a car. But yeah, 914, I've had things like a VW Iltis, loads of weird stuff, VW Golf Country. So I like my weird things. But normally, simple mechanicals are what best for me, because I don't want to start spending too much money.
I mean, you say about dropping engines out, that's something I'm hoping to do on Sunday. I've got to yet again pull the engine out of my MG Midget, which is again broken. This time, though, I didn't drive it into a river and hydrolock it. This one simply gave out somewhere near Goodwood on the way down to the revival earlier this year in spectacular fashion. Temperature hits the peg, oil pressure completely vanished, and there was an almighty clattering coming from somewhere inside the sump. So we're yet to do the diagnosis on what went wrong there. Turns out you can buy an engine for 350 quid off of Facebook. That doesn't guarantee it will work. But yeah, that's an ongoing project, and looking forward to getting on with that one.
I think that's what I've always liked about air-cooled VWs. You don't have to deal with all the waterworks and all the, you know, the hoses and the, you know, the jacket around the engine. You know, I don't need to mess with any of that. And so, you know, if you're going to tackle that, then good luck to you, because it's not my kind of thing.
It's, yeah, a relatively involved job. Thankfully, the last one went, the engine went in quite easily with the help of a friend from Red Bull Racing, but might be me just pulling it out and trying to figure out what's gone wrong with it before I get him back to reinstall a replacement. But we'll see how it goes. Anyway, that's the three of us introduced. We'll delve into the first topic, which is another lighthearted round of what's already standing out to you at this year's show. Obviously, celebrating 40 years of the Classic Motor Show at the NEC. What's jumping out to you? We've got some fantastic clubs. We've got more clubs than ever before, I believe, I'm correct in saying.
Yeah, so this year's Classic Motor Show, a record 338 clubs taking part. More than 3,000 classics on show across 6 halls of the NEC this year. And the thing with the Classic Motor Show I always find is it never ceases in its ability to surprise you. Even if you go every single year, there's always something that is jaw-dropping, I find, when I'm going around. And this year is no exception. There have been some absolutely exceptional cars. There is, in Hall 5, there is a lovely Standard 10, which has done 360,000 miles. And it's still going. There's in Iconic Auctioneers in Hall 2, my favourite from the auction hall stand, there is a Ford Capri 1600, full nut and bolt restoration. It is stunning. This car is estimated to hit tomorrow to go for anything between £28,000 and £32,000, which might sound like a lot for a four-pot Capri, but actually, you know, you see the V6s going for that sort of money, but when you think about how much it would cost you to get a specialist to bring that up to scratch, you would probably spend at least that price and more, I would have thought, in bringing a car up to that condition. So I think that is going to be something that performs really strongly. My absolute favourite of the show so far, again, that's in Hall 5. This is the, have a look at the 1100 Club in Hall 5. They have an Austin 1100 drop head convertible. And the thing that makes this one unusual is that, yes, there are convertibles out there, but they tend to be cars that are converted by Crayford. This particular example has been engineered by Jensen, of all people. So when they weren't making Interceptors and FFs, they created this as a proposal. They took it to BMC, said, hey guys, do you want to make a convertible version of the 1100? British Motor Corporation said no. But what they did do is they took it to the 1967 British Motor Show, displayed it on Jensen's stand. It then went into a Jensen showroom for many years after that. And it kind of fell into disrepair over the years, but it's just had a full restoration and it's now on the stand at the NEC for the very first time in 40 years. It is stunning. Go and have a look at it.
Yeah, we did have a cheeky peek at that last night when we were doing our sort of preview, and it is, it actually works as a convertible as well. There's some cars that sort of people convert. I've seen, like, for me, the Citroen DS never worked as a convertible, but the 1300 and the 1100 works, actually. That body style works as a convertible, so it's quite a unique choice. Andy, what's jumping out to you so far? What should people immediately head off and go and find if they haven't seen it already?
Well, the, again, I've just mentioned Sarah Crabtree before, ran into her before, on the Mitsubishi Colt stand, which, it's a guy called, is it Steve Blackburn, have you come across him? Yeah. And his family, sort of, they were the people behind the Mitsubishi coming to the UK. So he's had, you know, decades of his family and the Mitsubishi. And he asked me before, have you ever owned a Mitsubishi? No, I once drove a Sapporo for Classic Car Weekly, and that was it. And, yeah, so that stand is worth checking out. I think it's in Hall 4, isn't it? Just from the entrance, and then keep going next to the tech kind of theatre. And, yeah, they've got three or four Colts on there. I mean, those cars didn't survive 2 years, never mind, you know, decades. And there they are, these beautiful cars, beautiful Japanese cars, and they're sitting there. And some gorgeous examples. I mean, I don't know how many exist out there in decent condition now to have, you know, a large club of any sort. But the examples we've got here in terms of the design and what you're seeing in terms of what would you could have bought in a showroom from this family back in the day, the family behind Mitsubishi in the UK. So that's great to see. It's a newcomer, isn't it? You know, you don't expect to see newcomers to the show in terms of a new mark to be celebrated.
Yeah, it's a new club as well, actually. Yeah. This today was the sort of the initial launch yeah, of the yeah, club. Yeah. And I will say I have been over, had a look, and they've got, I think it's two Gallants and a Lancer. And the
GSR.
The 2-litre GTO Gallant is absolutely stunning. Yeah, I really yeah. quite like that. But yeah, that's definitely a stand worth going and have a look at. For me, my standout, quite obviously, is the Mustang Owners Club stand. They've got 10 Mustangs lined up on there, celebrating the complete heritage of the Mustang from a 64 and a half all the way through to a brand new one that Ford have donated from their press fleet at the moment. It's a new S550. And it is stunning. And the actual display, they've even managed to somehow get hold of a Fox body, a lovely convertible Fox body, and a Mustang too. You never see those in the UK. And this one has not long been pulled out of a barn. They've sort of done a half barn find on it. They've one half sort of barn found, the other half they've cleaned up. But yeah, for celebrating six decades of the Mustang, it is perfect.
Did you know the Mustang 2 came to the UK in right-hand drive form as well?
Did it?
Yeah, yeah. I think 1976-ish, something like that.
I'm pretty sure
it did, yeah. Right-hand drive, and it was very crude conversion from left to right-hand drive. There used to be one doing the Northwest shows for a while, until it's probably rotted away. The only time you normally see those is on Charlie's Angels reruns in the 70s, wasn't it? Because they had the Cobra 2 or something it was called?
Yeah,
like
the Cobra Snake 2,
but
yes.
Yeah, the nice design, weren't they? But not a Mustang, in, you know, as we know it, I suppose. But, yeah.
it's a great celebration of the mark and the model, I'd say.
This is a great place to see cars that you wouldn't see normally at all the shows. And again, there are a lot of new car clubs taking part this year in the 40th year anniversary year for the Classic Motor Show. In Hall 1, they have the British Salmon Club. Again, these are cars that you don't typically see at most British shows. And, to be honest, actually, it's been a long time since I've seen any British Salmon at a show. But they have three there this year. It's celebrating 90th anniversary of the mark. And again, it's a really good opportunity to see some pieces of British motoring heritage that you wouldn't normally get to see. So actually, the NEC's halls are a really good opportunity to see things that you wouldn't normally get to see.
It's like a museum that just exists for 3 days a year, and it is a prime chance to go around and learn about things that otherwise would be forgotten if it weren't for the incredibly dedicated people that are sort of keeping them going. But when it comes to keeping things going, or certainly reinventing them, we've seen a couple of new cars floating around. I've already mentioned the new Mustang S550. They've got that on their stand. On the Renault 5 Owners Club, I believe, they've got the new Renault 5, or they're just calling it the R5 at the moment, this sort of electric reimagining of it. MG, somewhere down that way, which obviously I'm pointing makes no sense on an audio and a medium, have the new Cyberster, which I've had a brief go in and is interesting, to say the least. But it does beg the question, if you could bring back one historic motoring mark or one historic motoring model, what would you bring back and how would you reimagine it?
Well, that's a toughie, isn't it? I mean, I think the one that certainly I've seen generating a lot of traffic this year is the Morris Minor. It was the first British car, obviously, to sell a million. And there are two clubs this year celebrating the Morris Minor, which is including the brand new Morris Minor owners community. So that is something well worth checking out. One story we did see earlier in the year was they used AI to regenerate the Morris Minor. It wasn't a new car, but it seemed to do the rounds on the internet as being being purported as a new model. It was a very cleverly done AI regeneration of the car, and the interest that car got, I mean, some of the proportions didn't look quite right, but actually as a car, I would love to see what someone would do if they took the principles of the Morris Minor and repackaged them for the 2020s.
That's an interesting proposition. Again, a lightweight, affordable city car is something that's the market seems to be a bit deprived of, certainly when it comes to lightweight, easy to maintain, easy to run cars. You look at the modern Super Mini is debatable as to whether or not they're sort of truly an approachable car. Andy, what would you go for if you're going to reimagine something, bring something back?
Yeah, well, there's a lesson in not what to bring back, I think. With recently, the Myers Manx has been brought back as an electric car, EV. But it's made it, it's not very affordable anymore. It's not something you can take the engine out of and do anything with. So that probably went a little wrong in terms of that sort of that kind of idea. It's all right for one market. I mean, I'd like to see VW bring back a Karmann gear. I mean, it's something that's affordable, but that kind of shape. So something exotic that is affordable would be the ideal thing for me. But like you said, I think the trick is for a manufacturer to bring back something that people can work on. It might have an EV power plant. It might be something that might be sealed, and you could drop it out and move it to something else. But it needs something that, something for us to do, I think, on cars.
Well, that's where I've long been pondering the idea of, would BMW ever bring back Riley? I believe they own the rights to the Riley name, and I think BMW can make an absolute killing making lightweight sporting saloons, and you could have them with internal combustion engines or, heaven forbid, electric power plants, because the idea of Riley was it was lightweight sporting luxury. You could sort of combine all of those things into a relatively affable platform, and I think bring back Riley would be an interesting move. And again, if BMW wanted to think of an interesting way to sell their electric cars, certainly, as we're seeing some brands, Volvo did it with Polestar, they had a spin-off brand that was entirely electric. BMW might be wise to do the same thing with Riley, and I say that as a Riley fan, suggesting you put electric engines in them might get me thrown out of the social circles, but there are people doing worse things with Rileys, although some of them are my friends, but that's beside the point.
I think they already have form for this in a way, so anyone who was at the show last year might have seen the Makina TR25, which was very much an EV reimagining of the Triumph TR2. It appeared on the TR register stand this time last year. And actually, when you peel away the skin, which actually was a lovely homage to the original Triumph TR2 record breaking cars, underneath all the gubbins are BMW i3. So it can be done. They use that platform very effectively to create a real working car. It looked great. I'm sure that with BMW's know-how behind it, it would have driven fantastically. And the great thing is, of course, BMW, as far as I know anyway, they still own the rights to the Triumph brand, so they could bring back the Triumph TR quite happily using existing technology, and that would be a really good way of getting, in much the same way the MG has done with the Cyberster, a way of getting enthusiasts excited about cars again.
Well, obviously, BMW have worked with Toyota to make the latest iterations of the Z4 and the Supra, so they're not averse to making a lightweight sports car. I'm going to get a bit rogue here for our first ever podcast, going to go moving, because we've got in the audience, we've got engineer Ralph Hosier. Yeah, surprise. Ralph, if you were going to reinvent a classic car or a classic mark, which direction would you go in, and sort of what's your thought on it?
I think there's definitely a need for something there, and as has been already mentioned, I think a small, lightweight, easy to use, fun car is what we need. The equivalent of, you know, an Hillman Imp or the classic Mini. Something that just brings the entertainment back again. Small, lightweight, easy to use, easy to live with, and affordable.
Something you can use and drive and actually has a level of connection with you. That's what people are after. And that's one of the important things that sort of keeps people entertained with classic cars, because they also become a break away from the monotony of modern life. They're that brief chance to sort of step away and just sort of ignore everything else going on. It's that sort of important mental health break, which is one of the things this year's show is focusing on, is having that sort of bit of self-care, that self-mental health sort of awareness. Do you guys find the same thing with your cars? Are they a sort of a perfect opportunity to step away and take that pause?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important thing to bear in mind with classic cars. Unlike the your brand new car, maybe, which might be sort of more of a commodity, you use it as a thing to go to work and back, or something to take to the shops. With a classic car, it's very much the case that with a lot of these cars, whether it's an MG Midget or an Austin Allegro, or right up to sort of a, you know, Ferrari 330 GT, they're members of the family at the end of the day. These are cars that you have a nostalgic connection to them. It might be a car that certainly might be the car that you learned to drive in and you've bought it back. It might be a car that your dad or your grandfather had. And actually, it's those connections that actually are the driving force of this hobby. It's why people will go and bring along those Mitsubishis that you mentioned earlier. Why is it that they survive now? Why has someone put all of that time and the money into restoring and maintaining and looking after that car? And the reason is because they are really important to the people who have connections to them. So it's about nostalgia, it's about connections, and it's about people at the end of the day. That's what our hobby is all about, and it's why we have all of these clubs who have come along today. They've given up their spare time, their fuel, their money, and so on, to bring along these wonderful cars. And the most important thing, in terms of making sure that this hobby continues to grow, is we encourage the next generation to come along and get involved with these cars. So I was saying this on the live stage earlier as well. If you have a car here at the show, and a little lad or a little girl here comes along with their mummy and daddies, don't say, oh, don't touch the car. Get them to sit inside the car, behind the wheel, get them to do the thing where they're steering the car and looking out over the view of the bonnet, because it's those visceral emotional connections to cars which actually are the formative building blocks of, making them into petrol heads who will look after and cherish classic cars in years and decades to come.
Yeah, for me, I see the other side of this as well, where you kind of, your car is your escape. I mean, you go into the garage or you go in, just get into the car. Everything you touch and feel is from another time. It's almost like a time machine. It can take you places. And those places are where you meet people with similar thoughts about going somewhere and meeting people and escaping. Yeah, but for me, it's about getting in the car, shutting the door, driving, hearing those sounds and imagining you're somewhere else. So if you have a car from the States, or a car from the 50s, it's all those kind of things that come together, and it's those that sort of, do something to the senses. For me, it's that as well. I mean, yeah, of course, it is about bringing people together, but then the community is involved with it. But, even in the 90s, I remember going to Germany with my classic car experiences, and the States as well. And bringing people together, but I recreate those by sitting in my car from the States, This car has been there. It's kind of the dust and the dirt and the sound of the door and the engine. Everything just goes towards creating that feeling. So it is my little escape. It's my happy place for those reasons. And for somebody else, it might be the speed, or it might be going to the car meet and meeting people, or whatever, having a drink somewhere. But yeah. escapism for me.
The escapism is an important thing, but at the same time, you already mentioned it both, is the community side to it. It's the fact that it brings people together. You start having those conversations. I know with young owners clubs, it's a great way to meet other sort of young people, but at the same time, it's an experience or a problem shared is a problem halved, is sort of very much a theory. Yeah. And that can be spread to not only the problems you encounter with your cars, but just other bits. It's people that are exactly like you that are going to be sharing the same gripes. Becomes a really easy way to talk about them. But at the same time, you, when you come to fix your cars, I spend a lot of time fixing my MG with my dad, then it's a great way to sort of have more open conversations, because you can, it's a sort of open environment where it's just the two of us in the workshop. There is no sort of social pressures on it. It's just the two of us and the radio in the background, and it becomes a far more easy and open way to have those discussions. And certainly over the past year, while the car has been predominantly broken, it's actually been quite good for my mental health, despite the fact that my car is broken and a constant stress of when am I going to finally fix it. It's sort of almost counterintuitive, but it does work, and it is, it's one of those important sort of tools for just keeping you a little bit sane, even if it does drive you insane at the same time.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I was saying before about, this is a hobby that's about people as much as it is the metal. And some of my best friends are people who I've met through car clubs. It's going along to the pub. Even if it's going out on a Sunday morning and having a bacon roll and a cup of coffee, or you go out midweek to a pub, you meet up with like-minded petrol heads. And for me, that was always, that was always my escape. Certainly my background was working in weekly newspapers, and you'd have stressy days sometimes where you'd have like quite long deadlines and so on. Actually being able to get out in the car, drive out to a nice pub, sit down with people and just talk cars and see what people have been up to, I think actually that kind of puts you in your happy place, and driving there and driving back, and it's the experiences, the sounds, the smells, even the vibrations you get, which you don't get in modern cars. It's an assault on the senses, and it helps to remove you from the sort of the pressures and week to week.
It sort of refocuses the mind on just the driving experience and shuts everything else out and gives you that moment of tranquility. And you say about sort of going to club meets, obviously we've, as a title, have been fortunate enough to host our own club meets through the year. We've had great success with those at Withall Transport Museum. Do we know if they're coming back next year? Because they are so much fun to go along to, meet readers of the title, but also it's just that perfect sort of pause at the end of a week, sort of once a month, just to go out and have those conversations and sort of just completely forget the stress of the world and just sort of have a look at somebody else's car and go, oh, yours works.
I'm happy to confirm that they are. So Coffee and Cars Withall, which was held pretty much down the road from here, from the NEC, Withall Transport Museum, which is better known for its historic bus collection. They have more than 90 historic buses and coaches, one of which is here in Hall 5 on the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Club stand. Well worth checking out if you're here at the show this weekend. We started back in, it was actually this time last year at the NEC, we said, hey, why don't we do a coffee meet? And it started from there, and it started fairly small at first, but it's grown and grown over the course of this summer. And we got to the point where, I think it was our September meet, we had 144 different vehicles all flooding into this museum, and there were all sorts of different vehicles. We had not just classic cars as well, we had historic scooters, bikes as well, commercial vehicles, loads of different makes, models, eras of cars as well. And it's gone down really well. I know the museum have been absolutely thrilled with the response as well. So I'm quite happy to confirm that, yes, we will be meeting up again Sunday mornings throughout the summer next year. CCW will be there. It's a great opportunity, again, to meet the experts who are involved in producing Classic Car Weekly every single week, seeing our cars, and we will come along and talk to you guys as well, and we want to know what kind of cars you've got too.
I will say, you keep referring to me as an expert, but my car is mostly broken most of the time, so it's a bit of a stretch of the phrase, but yeah, certainly when the MG is working, it'll be there. But yeah,
when your MG is working,
when is the operative phrase,
when/if, who knows.
Let's not go far as if it will work, it's just a case of when.
You need an air cooled VW, that's what you need.
Don't tempt me. James Peen, our news editor, has got one, and I'm constantly tempted because I'm like, oh, I do like the Beetle. But that's the question, obviously cars that are constant temptations. We're all going to have our little temptation cars. What are the cars that, if all of a sudden money were no object, your premium bond numbers come up, you win the lottery, what's the one that you would immediately go out and get a hold of?
Oh, that is a very tough one, isn't it? I mean, I was window shopping at the Iconic Auctioneers stand over in Hall 2 earlier, and there were so many cars. I think, luckily, my wife Natalie is in charge of the wallet, I think, on this one, because I would have bought about 15 cars probably before the car auction even started. There was one that really caught my eye, though, and it was a Mini Cooper Sport. Only had 8,000 miles on the clock, and it's got a 24 grand estimate, but it's the closest thing you're going to get to a brand new 90s Mini Cooper. It looks fantastic. And I know that on the roads back here, it would be an absolute blast to drive. That would be, we were talking before about nostalgia. My first two cars were Minis, and they are so much fun to drive. So that to me would be hitting all the right nostalgia buttons. It's the closest thing to a brand new Mini. As long as you looked after it, it'd give you years of reliable service as well. And it's small enough to fit in most garages. So I think if it were me, I was going to go for a Mini, I'd go for the best Mini of the lot.
Is that an hydroelastic suspension? What year was it?
2000.
All right, okay. Ooh,
so
it's not.
Yeah, I have a fun story about that. I remember when I was at school, so not rewinding the clock a great distance, but I snuck out of school one afternoon to go and test drive one that I knew was at a local dealership. So I sat there secondhand on the forecourt. I was like, ooh, 1997. So it's the same age as me, Tahiti blue, white roof, stripes, sports exhaust. And I was like, ooh, I'll do that. So I snuck out one lunchtime, headed down to the dealership and sort of went out for a test drive in it, up and down the A6 on the between the roundabouts. And I was absolutely blown away by actually how quick they are as well, because they weigh the square root of nothing, and those fuel-injected engines go like a stabbed rat. So all of a sudden, I was like, oh, that BMW driver is a bit terrified that I came shooting past him off a roundabout, because much like every Mini Cooper you drive in a performance setting, you just sort of apply steering lock, mat it, and just wait for the understeer to straighten you out on the bends. Yeah. But they are fantastic fun, so I can agree with you on that one being the temptation.
You've just unlocked a kind of a thought of a secret project that I have in the back of my mind, which is to find a Mini Sprite from about 1994-ish, and do a...
I had one.
Well, do a Born... is it Born Ultimatum or Born Identity?
The first one, Identity, wasn't it?
Do a Born kind of Mini, right, with a knackered wing on it, and the the sunroof and those bumper bars at the back. It'd have to be left-hand drive, of course, but, to be honest, a standard Mini, you can have fun in a standard Mini, can't you? But yeah, that's my secret little project one day, is to just find a red, it has to be that kind of red, you don't have to do much to it, and...
slightly sun faded red owned by a French lady. Yeah. That's the ultimate Born Identity Mini. Go on then, money, no object, premium.
Well,
bond,
that would be that. That
up.
Would be one of them, because I'd spread it, I think. I've always said I'd fancy a 68 fastback Mustang from Bullitt, you know what I mean? But to be honest, I'm not a Ford guy. That would be on the list, but steering wise, the ones I've driven, the steering's a bit like steering a ship. I've always fancied a Myers Manx. I mentioned that before. I've always fancied an original sort of 64, 65 Myers Manx. I spoke to the guy years ago who first built them, Bruce Myers. I saw the number one was at the Revival this year. I think some of us saw that there. Simple to work on, but a lot of fun, but not great for this weather, which is probably why I own the VW that I have, because it's a bit like a beach buggy, but there's an optional roof that comes and goes off it, really. But yeah, I'm not a 60s Myers Manx, really, with metal flake, deep dish wheels, that kind of thing. But the Mustang, 68 Mustang from Bullitt, I think that's still there. If it was set up right, I'd need to keep some aside to make sure it was actually drivable.
Complete QA1 front suspension overhaul really dials the front end in on those. But it's interesting you mentioned cars from film, because that's the easy answer for me is always going to be 1977 Smokey and the Bandit. It's got to be a Pontiac Firebird Trans Am finished in that package. I think for me there is no greater car that I could sort of get hold of, money no option, pick one up and enjoy it. That would be the car for me if I had the opportunity to. And again, I keep an eye on the market, I keep an eye on what they're doing in the States, and think, well, if I saved really hard and then figured out a way of getting it back to the UK, it would be the ultimate car for me.
I remember my first want was probably about 1978, 79, giving away my age. And there was a TV series on telly on Saturday mornings called California Fever, and they had a 71 Trans Am, I think it was, in that Firebird, with the twin nostrils, but with amazing paintwork on it. And I remember seeing that, and I just always wanted that for years. In fact, today, on the way down this morning, I was imagining myself in a day van from the 70s, with a window porthole at the side and all the fur and the fairy dice and that kind of stuff. I don't know why, but I think I saw a Trans Am and I thought, Yeah, I'd like something big like that. What about a day van from the 70s? Probably a bit off topic from what we've been talking about. I'm probably not very family friendly because they created a lot of families.
Yeah, the history of the 70s day van, certainly through America, was an interesting one. But I think there's plenty out there across the sort of, what have we got, seven halls here that across the weekend?
Six halls, so you've got halls 1 through to 5, and then you've got hall 8 as well, which is well worth having a look at. That's the hall that's predominantly given over to Ford clubs, and again, there are some absolutely phenomenal cars in there as well, including Escort RS Cosworth.com, which is a brand new club, and they have an Escort Cosworth prototype on their stand. So if you like fast Fords, I'd definitely recommend having a mooch round Hall 8 and checking out what's on show there.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I noticed in Hall 5, there's a lot of VWs all parked around the near the stage area. So they've put all the VW clubs together, and there's a Swallowtail Golf from about 74, 75. Amazing to see how the Golf started, because the gear stick and the gear knob are just straight out of a Beetle. I mean, you know, they built them pretty much. You can see that crossover between the two. Pretty much they were just a mishmash of design ideas, you know, from one decade to the new decade of the water-cooled cars. But it's nice to see that down there.
Before I get distracted by the phrase giant pendulous wand, which could easily describe the Mark 1 Golf's gear lever, we'll pretty much wrap it up there. It's been about half an hour, a nice little chat, and I'll let you both head off to enjoy the rest of the Classic Motor Show. There's still a lot to go and see and enjoy. So without further ado, Andy Talbot, thank you very much. David?
Thank you. It's worth keeping an eye out as well for Classic Car Weekly coming out next Wednesday, the 13th of November. We have our big NEC Classic Motor Show special issue, so bumper issue packed with all of the best cars from this year's show. We're also looking back at 40 years of the show, first started in 1984, same year Ghostbusters came out, and I'm sure just as popular, and have a look at that. You know, it's full of show nostalgia, our favourite cars, all the best buys. Be out in all good news agents on Wednesday, and probably some bad ones as well.
Perfect. And of course, make sure you sort of subscribe to Classic Car Weekly. That's the best way to never miss an issue. But of course, pick up our NEC Classic Car Weekly special issue, isn't it? So that's what it's going to be. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening to our first ever proper podcast of sorts, one which we decided to very perilously do live. And hopefully this will become a slightly more regular thing. I'll try and get all the boys together in the office and we'll make this far more interesting on a weekly-ish basis. I'll call it weekly-ish. That doesn't hold us to too much promise. Otherwise, thank you for listening, and we'll be back, hopefully, in a week-ish.